I tend to like poems that have a tonal range where, you know, one line is devastatingly sad, and then the next line you want to laugh. That to me feels like a really good experience of not just poetry, but of art. There is joy, true joy, in the release and the articulation and the expression of suffering. Like that is what is happy. When I'm able to write a poem that gives voice to something really dark that I've been carrying, that I've been feeling, like that's the biggest fucking joy in the world.
Hello, welcome to the Ruth Stonehouse podcast. I'm Bianca Stone, and I'm thrilled to be talking today with the poet Ben Perkert, who is the author of the forthcoming novel, The Men Can't Be Saved, from Overlook in 2023. His poetry collection, For the Love of Endings, from Four Way Books in 2018, was named one of Android's best poetry books of the year. His writing has appeared in many magazines, including The New Yorker, The Nation, Kenyon Review, Poetry Magazine, and elsewhere. And he holds degrees from Harvard and NYU, where he was the New York Times Fellow, and he is the editor of Backdraft, a Guernica interview series focused on revision and the creative process. And it's really one of my favorite things out there. He teaches creative writing at Rutgers. And Ben, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me, Bianca. It's good to see you.
It's really good to see you too. You talk a lot about revision and process on Backdraft, and when I was reading through For the Love of Endings, I was struck by how careful and elegantly the whole book is put together. And I do a lot of manuscript consults, so I'd spend a lot of time thinking about process and manuscript creation, and I was wondering if you could talk a bit about what the revision process was like and the creation was like for your first book of poetry.
Yeah, for sure. And your students are lucky to have you. I mean, you know, I think the first book is kind of such a weird experience because, you know, every book thereafter is sort of, it doesn't have to be this, but it has the potential to be a reaction or a response or an evolution or a correction. Like it has some relationship to what has come before it, whereas the first book sort of enters into this void, like into this silence. And I remember feeling like that was creatively a lot of pressure, actually, because you know I didn't have sort of a voice at all, right? Like it was just sort of it's like the blank page that the poem exists on, but also you as a writer are sort of entering into this blank page. So I remember feeling that pressure tremendously. And I did the best that I could to sort of take that pressure and use it as a force that would help me shape the poems, right? Like instead of me just feeling sort of immobilized by that pressure of like, oh shit, I'm trying to publish a first book, I want it to be good, I want, you know, I think that was inevitable but not terribly healthy. Whereas if I could take that pressure and sort of apply it to the poems and say, okay, instead of 3 pages, I think this poem could actually say it in one, or even like half a page, or just a single image. So, you know, maybe that doesn't totally answer the question of sort of like the curation of a manuscript as a whole, but I exerting a kind of pressure in a positive way as opposed to a self-destructive way was one of the things I had in mind in putting the book together.
I think that's really on point because I think the pressure of having the first book be everything you want it to be, even though you don't even really know what you want or what it might look like, is there's I think pressure can also be manipulated and construed and used to be something more like excitement, right? And like energy and not like a strangling, this must be something possibly it could never be. And it's easier said than done, of course, because you expect and want so much out of it. But I love that. But also that you said, you know, oh, maybe that, you know, using that pressure to think about condensing poems. And that takes so much, I feel like that takes a lot of actually a lot of humility to be able to cut so much of a poem, you know, a 3-page poem down to a 1/2-page poem. It does take a lot of humility because you have to be throw away what all the things that you said, but in the end, it's the some most of the time the greatest decision ever, because it's not about length with poetry, right?
Right. Yeah, I think, you know, it's also, I think, for me, kind of like realizing what your strengths and weaknesses are as a poet, and trying to, on the one hand, accept them and be aware of them, but also trying to sort of push against them a little bit. I really admire poets who, like one of my teachers was Jory Graham. Jory uses like a really long line. There's so much breath in a Jory poem.
Right.
And I remember, you know, I was taking one of her workshops, and I was bringing in these poems that were really, really short. And I think, you know, Jory sort of asked the question, like, why are these poems so short? Like, are you afraid to say more? Are you afraid to sort of breathe more into the poem? Are you afraid? Are you like, are they short because that's what you're good at? Or are they short because you're holding something back? And these are not questions that I think necessarily need to be answered or can be answered, but they were the right questions, at least for me to toy with and consider. And so, you know, now, you know, even not like even now, like it's been so long, but you know, it feels to me like even now and for the rest of my life as a writer and as a poet, that's a question that I'll ask myself. Like, is the poem at its length because I'm hesitant or I'm hesitating, or no, does it really need to be, you know, the length that it's at?
Right. It's not about long or short. It's about what is the poem demanding and what am I avoiding looking at? Either I'm avoiding saying something or I'm burying something with a lot of other stuff to avoid saying it in that way as well. Mm-hmm. Because both are kind of the same tactic. But that's sort of the kind of questions, right, I guess one would ask in that endless revision process of a book. You know, is this poem, is it doing what I want it to do or not? And if it's not, what am I going to do about it?
Right, exactly.
Well, go ahead.
No, and you know, sometimes in the absence of a workshop, like it's one experience when you're in an MFA or if you're in a college workshop or a not-for-credit workshop, and you can sort of pawn some of these questions off on others. when that program ends or that course ends, your life as an independent, I mean, no one is truly independent, right? And there's always friends that you can show your work to. But some of those questions that I think we get trained to sort of like spray into a field, like, you all tell me, what do you like the title? Do you not like the title? Suddenly now, you know, you're a bit more alone, which I think is both can be really intimidating and also liberating, because Lord knows the workshop doesn't always, like the workshop always thinks that it has the answer. But of course, you know, they're coming at it from outside the work, which gives them perspective, but also, you know, they're not you. I think, you know, one thing I wanted to say real quick is like I'm really interested in poems. I'm really interested in writing in general that acknowledges the process of its own making, and like a poem that will tell you, hey, I'm a poem. Just because it's almost awkward to me when a poem doesn't do that on some level. Like, it's just like,
right.
Don't act like you're just, you know, a daisy in a graveyard. Like, you're a poem about a daisy in a graveyard. That's a meaningful distinction. So take off your mask, poem. And part of the reason that I think the book took that ending of For the Love of Endings is because it's almost like a commentary a little bit on how I write and my tendencies. I love endings. They're my favorite part of poems, always. But I think that I have a tendency to sort of want to get to the ending quickly because I'm comfortable there. That's where I want to live. And so that accelerates in ways that can be productive or not productive. And that I think that's why I'm really interested in the question of length and breath in a poem. Because increasingly I'm trying to sort of be more paced and not try to get to the end quickly, you know?
Well, it is ironic that your poems are very short often, but not necessarily, actually. I'm thinking of the long title poem, long because it's in sections, but they're very short little vignettes. But I can tell entirely what you're saying here. I would love it if you read some of those from The Love of Endings. You could probably read the whole thing, actually. I think that'd be fine. If you you can skip around.
Okay, cool. That sounds good. So this is the title poem for The Love of Endings. The blank page always wins. Not because of its blank stare, but because it speaks. It makes sense. Letters, commas, left out in the cold. It skips happily over the mind, heads right for the throat. Let me start there. I enjoy weeping in convenience stores. At least I'm being recorded on black and white film. I'll loop over myself for hours. I'll shoplift, simply to nail down my dominant hand. Junk food on the shelf sometimes cries out to me. El Diablo Doritos are screaming my name. I passed a billboard today that got under my skin. It hurt to drive my car, seeing ads for sleeker cars. What am I? A bad husband? A future pair of wandering eyes? In my dreams, the whole world falls for each other. I hope the afterlife is one giant pretzel with milk. I'm not talking about forever. I'm killing time with snow angels as I sprinkle salt on my drive. Sad little ghosts. If God exists, God exists to disappear. Spoiler alert. Here's my ending. I'm confined to a bed while my mind drifts in and out like another overworked nurse on her phone. Nurse, I shout, but she's already gone. Someone fills in, someone with her same face. Please, I say, give me the truth. She keeps dancing around it. Should I bury my face in this book? I have a tired obsession with death, not real death, just the moment when my lover loses steam, crashing beautifully on the couch. Her eyes are closed, so I close mine to be closer to her. If a cartoon coyote blows up the bridge on which he stands, his dreams go up in smoke. All animated characters are basically homeless in search of a body. They run around in circles in two dimensions. They fall off cliffs because that's all they have. The TV reminds me of sunlight. It's nice being burned in the comfort of my own skin. I'll whiten my teeth until they soar through the sky, until they sink themselves suddenly into the moon. Why else go outside? The rain's stuck again in the rain. In any standing ovation, the cheering fans rise to their feet because, sadly, they block their own view. I can learn from this as a writer. Whatever looks like praise is an obstruction of something else. People are drowning in breaking news. The whole world is watching the world just watching. Even planets are falling in stature, their hearts too slack. Tell me, what song could lift them? And how would it go? I'll name my child Gloom, because I'd like her to be happy. I want Gloom running free in tall grass, the sun licking the blades at her waist. I want the other children to jump rope with Gloom, maybe braid Gloom's hair. When I was little, I knew a faith. She never went far. I like my poems to look me in the eye. They should know their father, know where to stick the knife. When I'm gone, the thing I'll miss is missing, is describing the world I miss. So much depends upon you, reader. Look how these words lean on you, not even knowing your name.
It's beautiful. I found this book to have such a overwhelming calm and consistent tone, and the speaker to be like a very strong and individual I in the book. And yet at the same time, I really felt this ghost of a kind of screaming, frantic voice behind that too.
That's my subconscious, and, Bianca. You heard.
Right?
Yeah.
No, I heard the subconscious, the primordial scream. But it just was getting me thinking about tone in poetry, and especially emotional tone. And I was wondering if you could tell me a bit about how you see emotion and tone working and functioning in poetry. I was thinking of that line in the poem you just read, whatever looks like praise is an obstruction of something else. Hmm. And also the idea of, I'll name my child Gloom because I'd like her to be happy. I guess this idea of like saying one thing and meaning another, or like having contradictions in the poems themselves through tone. Mm-hmm. Or what you think about and play with when you think about setting the tone for a poem or for a book.
Yeah. I think, I was talking to Kaveh Akbar the other day, and Kaveh said this thing. I don't know if this is original to him or if he was, you know, repeating something that another poet had told him, but it's this idea that, like, as poets, we talk about how the art form that poetry is closest to being music. Like, everyone acknowledges that poetry and music are so similar and share origins, and that's 100% true. But you could also make a case that the art form that poetry is closest to is comedy. Another art form that's really, really focused on language and precision and timing and pace
and
insight. And also, mm-hmm. you know, a good joke is hilarious, but there's also oftentimes like a sadness that is underneath it, right? I'm talking, you know, you and I are talking right now in the wake of like yet another horrible gun violence tragedy, and there's that The Onion, like every time this happens they do that thing, right, where it's like you know, how, I forget exactly what it is, and which is a shame, maybe you remember.
No, it's like
the only country where this happens. Oh, yeah.
No way to prevent this is only nation where this regularly happens.
Exactly. And that's the thing, right? Like, you and I tried to do it and we butchered it, and then you read it and you're like, oh, I wouldn't change a single word of that. That's so perfect.
Right.
I think there is a poem-like quality to a really good piece of comedy. And, you know, you asked about tone. I'm going to try to get there. But I think for me, like, something really opened up when I realized that poems didn't just have to be serious. Like, the term being to be a poet is like a really serious mantle. But then you read people like James Tate, Heather Crystal, Joe Wenderoth. These were some poets who, you know, or going further back, like even someone like Catullus, who's like super hilarious in his like really raunchy and like fucking weird way.
Right.
You know, I think when I started reading folks like that, I think that was a tonal register where I was like, oh, that's my personality. Like, that's where suddenly I don't have to wear a mask in my poems anymore. I can sort of be gloomy, or it's always bad to like call yourself funny, but I can try to be funny, you know?
Right.
So I tend to like poems that have a tonal range where, you know, one line is devastatingly sad, and then the next line you want to laugh. That to me feels like a really good experience of not just poetry, but of art.
Yeah, and it can really resist the drama too, in that we can talk about really hard things and in a way that doesn't feel, well, it's almost like when things feel too dramatic, it's like we shut off a certain part of our mind to mm-hmm. thought. So I take this book to be partly about relationships. What do you think, what's unique for you in using poetry to explore our intimate relationships with people?
Well, that's a really interesting question. I mean, to start with the book, I mean, endings, you know, a lot of the poems in the book, most of the second section is about an ex. And, you know, so endings there seems that it could refer to the end of a relationship and what happens when someone who's a significant other becomes sort of like an ex significant other. And,
right.
You know, they don't end. It's just that the relationship ends and then this other person exists and you exist mm-hmm. and suddenly you're running into each other in the laundromat and you're supposed to pretend that you're strangers or you're supposed to reconnect. I mean, that was both a fascinating thing and a hurtful thing as I was going through it while writing some of these poems. I mean, I think, you know, you asked about poetry in general and its relationship to relationships and intimacy and breakups. I don't know. I mean, I think, how would you, I mean, there's some of that in your work too. Like how do you think about that relationship?
Well, it's funny because in this book I felt, it's something I've been feeling a lot actually in poetry it feels like a wandering soul or something, you know, like it's like the poet is like, there's a certain kind of poet that's like, feels like a wanderer, you know? Mm-hmm. And like, and while they're wandering through the world, they're supposedly interacting with other people. Other people are coming and going in the poems, crowds are coming and going. And yet it feels so like, it feels so singular. It feels like the mind. It feels like inside the head. Hmm. Yet, or does it? I don't know. I mean, it's like there or some element of like, it's an individual experience, an individual's experience, or what are these conversations that we're having in the poem? Is it, you know, partly, of course, there's always conversations with ourselves going on, right? So we're having this like constant conversation with ourselves, different parts of ourselves. But I guess I was thinking in your book, thinking about the ex, thinking about the speaker's sort of desire to connect with somebody, and it felt very much about desire. It felt, you know, and of course the family, I think there's a poem that mentions your daughter. But regardless, is this sort of like talking about our relationships with certain people in our lives, like poetry seems to offer up a unique way to do that. That I'm not sure. I know you're writing a novel right now, and that's a very different kind of way to talk about people's relationships in the world. And that, for instance, I have no idea really what your novel's about beyond the short synopsis on Twitter, but even right there, how is it? I mean, I guess that's completely different because you're not talking about your own relationships with other people in the novel. It's characters, right?
Well, that's like the whole question of like, you know, how much is your life versus versus the characters that you create. Maybe what I'll do real quick, I'll read this poem Dear X, because I think it'll allow us to maybe chat about this a bit, and then I can connect it to the novel. So this is a shorter poem. It's called Dear X. Dear X, I'm hardly alone. Like most men, I'll gaze at anything to avoid looking inward. Like how a stream reflects what surrounds, but never the face of itself. I mean force. I mean, forget it. Let's cast ourselves into a pond, a still surface standing forever without a break. Let's freeze at the tipping point when you leave me here in the heart of this song. At least metaphors have my back. At least the swallows outside my window sound into each other. I hope they fly so far south they don't remember a thing. So the reason I wanted to read this poem is, you know, it's called Dear X, but when you have an X, or let me be clear in my pronouns, when I have an X, there are certain things that you might want to say, or I might want to say to that person, but I can't, right? Like different people have different relationships with their exes, right? There's lots of different forms that can take. But sometimes you find yourself in a situation where it would be totally inappropriate to confess something or speak in an intimate way with an ex who doesn't want that. But in a poem, I can address this X, right? In sort of however way I want, like the poem, I mean, within bounds, right? Within like legal bounds. So this poem, you know, titled Dear X, to some extent, I think is a speech act that can only happen in the existence of the art. It can't happen in real life. I can't send this letter. I can't say these things necessarily. Not that they're salacious. Really what they are confessions. And part of the reason I wanted to read this poem in particular, that line, like most men, I'll gaze at anything to avoid looking inward. That was a line that for me really captured something about masculinity as I observe it / experience it. And so the novel, I didn't realize this consciously, but the novel that I've written is sort of an interrogation of masculinity and what is toxic about it. And I think that failure to look inward, to cast the gaze outward and objectify, when really there needs to be sort of an internal reckoning, that has always felt to me like something really powerful and necessary to explore further.
To what extent, Ben, does suffering enter into your poetry? Suffering.
Suffering, you said? Suffering. That's a light one. Well, that word suffering, I almost feel hesitant to claim it, because it's such a big word, and we live in a world in a time of such big suffering. So we talked 2 minutes ago about gun violence and what just happened in Texas. Like, you know, part of me, I want to say that I don't know suffering. You know, I don't know suffering in the way that that, for example, those families know suffering right now. So, you know, that's partially how I want to answer this, with some degree of humility and, you know, recognition of certain privileges or certain degree of safety. But I think another answer that to me feels true is that I think a lot of art and creative writing that really moves me is coming out of a place of deep pain. They can't be articulated in any other way but the poem or the novel or the mural. in which sort of it exists. So I think for me, you know, people talk a lot about, like, understandably, I'm not mocking this impulse, but, like, you know, hey, Professor Bianca, or hey, Professor Ben, why don't you bring in some happy poems? And, you know, like, why are all the poems sad that are on the syllabus? And I do usually have, like, a happy poem that I can sort of bust out, and, you know, I try to crowd please, like, as best as I can. Got to keep those Rate My Professor scores, you know, in the high fours or whatever. But like, for me, there is joy, true joy, in the release and the articulation and the expression of suffering. Like, that is what is happy. When I'm able to write a poem that gives voice to something really dark that I've been carrying, that I've been feeling, like, that's the biggest fucking joy in the world. It's like that's where that happy. I mean, happiness feels small in comparison to what I'm talking about, you know? So that's, to me, where the suffering sort of lives. And then through the poem, it's not that it's solved, right? Art is not therapy. The Ann Carson, you know, one of many brilliant things Ann Carson has said over the years. I don't believe that art is therapy, but I do believe that there is true joy in giving voice to something that you are carrying that is heavy, you know?
You mentioned bringing poems into your students. You teach creative writing at Rutgers. I find that teaching poetry is such a strange and beautiful thing, or it can be. And I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about your experience teaching poetry, or I assume you teach poetry, creative writing, I guess it could be fiction. Mm-hmm.
No, mechanical engineering. Yeah, I can't teach anything but poetry. That's the only thing. Maybe fiction now, I guess.
In what ways do you think workshop can be really helpful to poets? And I'm sure as a person who's been through an MFA as well, you have a lot to say about this. How is the workshop helpful? And when is it not helpful? And what are the ways that you have altered the way that you teach and the way that you interact with other people in maybe your own sharing and exchange of poems to make it the most it can be at this point in your life?
Yeah, that's interesting. And also, for those watching or listening, when Bianca came onto the Guernica Backdraft interview and we talked about workshop, and I loved what you said.
I can't remember. So
for those of you
who
are curious, it was smart. Check out that interview. I think, you know, I like the verbs that you used. Like, workshop can be a lot of different things.
Yeah.
Like, I think we get in trouble when we presume that, like, workshop is always going to be a positive and productive space. Like, maybe, you know, like, maybe. Part of that is the professor doing the right work? Are the students invested? On the other hand, I think there are some people who just, I don't want to say discount, but, you know, if you have a negative experience in workshop, that can really color your view of the potential of workshop as a practice. And in my experience, you know, it's really that can be. Workshops can be wonderful, or they can be really harmful. And so it's everyone's job, especially the professor or whoever's leading it, to sort of, you know, make sure that there isn't harm going on first and foremost, but that it's also, you know, we're pushing each other in a way that feels productive and creative and all the right things. I love the workshop space when it's going well. I think that one thing that, like, Rutgers, like a lot of universities, and I'm an adjunct, so I probably shouldn't say anything negative, right? But since I'm hired semester to semester on a piece of tissue paper, but like a lot of universities, the workshops are too big. There's like 22 people who usually take
my poetry class. Oh, wow, that is really big for a workshop. Yeah. Wow.
It's really big. And if any of my Rutgers students are listening, I love them. I love teaching at Rutgers, but it's way too big. The one good thing about it being that big, and quick credit, by the way, to Adam Fitzgerald, who helped get that number down, because I think it was at like 25 something before. So if you can believe it, that's progress. But anyway, hi, Rutgers.
I'm sure Rutgers is going to be listening to my podcast, but
yeah, just a disembodied Rutgers. Like Rutgers, like the mascot. What I have found is that I break them up into workshop groups. So when I was teaching at NYU, I was leading the workshop, right? And so there's that thing that happens that is totally natural, but people can be performative when they know that the teacher is listening, right? Whereas if you break a room of 20 people into four groups of five, I'm not everywhere at once. And so I need to sort of trust that they can workshop each other respectfully and intelligently and, you know, in all the right ways without it going through, without it going through me. And while I wish it were smaller so that we didn't have to do that, I think it has helped me cede control a little bit and just think of my role in sort of a different way. Because a great workshop is never really about the person teaching it. It's about what the students are giving to one another. And I think that as a teacher, I've always sort of known that, but I've really come to know it more in my experience of teaching, you know?
I love that so much. Just hearing you talk about that makes me think, that would be really, like, I do crave doing that more, like having them talk to each other and run their own little like mini workshops within the workshop. It's very empowering and I love that. What are some of the biggest mistakes that new writers make?
That's an interesting question.
That you've noticed as a teacher, maybe some things that recur.
I guess I mean the literary community, we've sort of decided that there are these categories. There are emerging writers, and then there are established writers. And I don't know that that's true. Like, obviously it is true in some sense, right? If you're publishing your first book versus your 10th book, the person who's writing the 10th book is more established. That seems like just fact. But I think that, you know, really great writers truly are emerging in different ways. Like you think of someone like two of the poets. I mean, I know, you know, greatest is a problematic term, but two of them, for my money, Lucille Clifton and W.S. Merwin are two of the greatest American poets that we have. Or that we had, thankfully, and we can claim. And there are two poets who, like, when you read their collected, you just see that they are constantly emerging and reemerging. Like, it's always them. It's always their voice. But there's such evolution. Like, what Merwin was doing at age 80, you know, was different. It was, like, meaningfully different than what he was doing in his 30s and 40s in this really cool way. You know, Clifton, too, in terms of, like, what she was writing in her later years versus... So... You know, I think really established writers are meant to constantly emerge in new ways. Similarly, I think of some younger poets who establish themselves right from the jump. Like, I'll answer it a slightly different way. One of the mistakes I think maybe that we make in the writing community is that we have this binary of emerging writer and established writer or almost sometimes like an implied versus, like you're either one or the other, right? And I guess I, you know, I would challenge that a little bit. Like, I think a lot of my favorite writers are writers who constantly emerge in different ways. Their work is evolving and changing and loosening throughout the course of their career. And some of my favorite emerging poets, like, you know, for example, I know you know Salmaz Sharif, who went to the NYU MFA with us. Like, she was an emerging poet when Look came out. But that book, there's nothing emerging about that book. Like, it's 100% established. It's 100% baked, you know? It feels foundational.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I'm thinking more like people who aren't, I guess, I don't know if you work with a lot of people who like are very new to writing poetry. Maybe they haven't been through an MFA maybe, or maybe they have been through an MFA, but they just haven't done a lot of publishing or anything like that yet. They're not even emerging yet, but they're trying to find some way to gain momentum in understanding how to find their voice. But maybe I hear what you're saying is that maybe one mistake is focusing on being either a new or older writer, but
that is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Because I think yeah. There's like, are there mistakes that new writers make? Like, totally. Right. But I think that honestly, truly, I believe this, maybe one of the biggest mistakes is to label oneself in one's own head a new writer. Like yeah. I have college freshmen, you know, I teach a poetry class and then like I teach a multi-genre class. And the number of times that I hear like, you know, well, I'm just 19. Like, you know, these poems aren't supposed to be good. Like, what do you mean? You know, that like, look at Keats. Tell that to Keats. Yeah. Or
talk to Rimbaud.
I mean, I think that is, are there mistakes? Like, of course, but I truly think, I think that's the biggest mistake. It's the first mistake. And in some ways it's the easiest to correct, because all you need to do as a teacher is look someone in the eye and say like, do you have room to grow? Absolutely. Is there way more that you need to read? Totally. But the same is true of me. And let's make art together. Mm-hmm. Like that, if you can really embrace that and not discount that, oh, you know, you're a college freshman, so obviously these poems are going to be sappy and angsty and they're going to suck and you're going to be embarrassed of them. Maybe that's very likely, but don't presume that, because if you presume that, then we can't do great things together. You know, so I do think that is the single biggest mistake. And I think we have to be really careful to not reinforce it either consciously or unconsciously. And I'm not saying that all the work that, you know, undergrads or high school students produce is great. I am 100% not saying that. But the minute we label someone as, and I know you're not doing this, but, you know, the minute you sort of call someone new or emerging, I think you set a kind of expectation that can be damaging.
So we have time for maybe one more poem, and I would love to hear. I loved the last poem in the book, and in Zero Gravity. And if you wanted to read that, I would just be so happy.
Yeah, I would love to. I don't think I've ever read this poem. I mean, I've read it out loud, like to myself, but I don't. You know how, I'm sure you have this, there are some poems in your book that like you just, for whatever reason, you don't read them at readings. So this is a real exclusive. this is called In Zero Gravity. I'll flip my mind like a silver coin. I'll weigh less and less with each step, my eyes late to their sockets. Between this spaceship and my piece of crap car, there can be no comparison. Between here and home, there are miles of darkness in my heart. No explorer goes that deep. Columbus discovered nothing but his own likeness, etched in city squares, his granite face fixed on. Who really cares? The truth is so much less engraved. The truth is sailing across the sea and the sadness of not wrecking. I remember the boats upon boats. If one fills with water, it veers away from what it knows, starts a new life entirely.
You've been listening to the Ruth Stonehouse podcast. I've been speaking today with the poet and writer Ben Perkert. You can read more about Ben and his work, how to order his books, his online essays, check out his interview series Backdraft, and much more at benperkert.com. See you next time.